did one of my least favourite chores today, which is filling the car up. And I don't know if you guys saw that Dartford Bridge was closed last week for 11 and a half hours.
Was it a truck hanging off the side or something?
Yeah. And I saw it on TikTok, and there was one woman who lived 7 miles away from Lakeside, just across the bridge. And she'd left the house with 32 miles of fuel, and she was in the traffic jam for 11 hours, and she was in danger of running out of fuel. And the entire comment section was, well, you should have filled up before you went and made sure you could do the journey. And I thought, surely not. These people don't drive around with full fuel tanks, do they? The only reason I pulled in to the petrol station today was because I discovered the Toyota has an extra level. So the GT86 doesn't give you a distance to empty. It's just a bog standard fuel gauge and light. And I discovered today, if you leave the light on long enough, it starts flashing. And that's the only reason I decided to pull in and fill up today.
So your plan was that fuel stop bingo, where you just keep going until you run out, presumably.
My commute round trip is 6 miles, and I pass 2 petrol stations each way, and I still can't be bothered to go fill up. But it's mainly downhill, so on the way back. So it's like sort of, yeah, if I need to, I could just roll in or, you know, walk and get some petrol. I really hate filling up.
Okay,
that doesn't bother me.
The car I've got currently, I got in October, November, or something like that, and it had like half a tank of fuel in it or something when I got it, and it's got 6 bars. It's the fuel chart. It's digital, and when it gets to the last bar, it beeps when you start the car and it flashes. And one day I just thought, let's see how far it goes. So I just put a jerry can in the car, and I just drove it until it cut out. And I know that when it flashes, I can get around town roughly 50 miles.
Poof.
Legit research.
Nice.
Actually, let's wind back a little bit. So the GT86 doesn't give you a countdown till zero.
No, it's just, I'm quite surprised, actually.
That's a modern car. That's really surprising. Yeah. Even my Polo gives that, and my Polo is significantly older. My Polo does the, I guess, now traditional countdown to zero. I have hit zero more than once. But it was just zero. I didn't go much further than that. But I'm surprised that filling up your car is what you would call a least favourite chore. I don't mind filling up a car.
I can't stand it.
Petrol, I hate it. I like the smell of petrol.
I just hate spending the money. The actual act of getting petrol doesn't bother me, but just paying for it is just a pain.
I think part of the reason is because the petrol station I use for the GT86 especially, it isn't a pay at pump. So I've got to go in and deal with all that nonsense as well. But it's the only place around here that does the 99 RON fuel, so I've got no other choice unless I want to do a 40-mile round trip to get 99 RON fuel, which kind of defeats the purpose.
I like that the GT86 doesn't tell you how much fuel you've got left, but it is really picky about the fuel as well. These things seem at odds. It doesn't seem like the kind of... I don't know, it's like a car that's picky about the fuel. It should always tell you how much it's got left. Does the Jag tell you how much it's got left?
Yeah, but once it gets below 20, it just goes to zero. So my theory is I've always got at least 20 miles when it's on zero. And I'm fairly certain, like Matt's car, there's probably another 50 miles in it after that.
No, so you can flip that around. You've either got 20 miles left or it's always overestimated by 20 miles. You're just about to hit zero.
Exactly.
The Polo does this thing where every warning beep is the same beep. Are you slightly low on fuel? Beep. Are you due a service? Beep. Is the car on fire? Beep. There's no differentiation with the Polo. It just gives you the scariest bong in the world, and you're like, oh, it's 4 degrees, or the car's on fire. I'm not quite sure which.
Oh, man.
The red warning light on it is the exact same beep as the frost symbol, put it that way.
I went to Cardiff at the weekend. You can work out why. And I borrowed my sister's Hyundai i10, brand new 25-plate car. And in one drive... It beeped at me when I started the car. It beeped at me to tell me the car in front of me was pulling away. It beeped at me because I went near the speed limit. It beeped at me to tell me I needed a brake. And then when I turned the car off, it beeped at me to tell me to check the rear seat for passengers. Oh, and the lane assist as well was pulling the steering wheel, yeah.
There's a few things I'd like to discuss. The first one being, it beeps when the car in front pulls away.
Yeah. Yeah.
But why? What's that one for?
I guess it's just assuming that everybody's so distracted these days that they need to be told, you know, that without looking in front of them, that the car beside them, the car ahead is pulling away.
It's a Hyundai i10, so, you know, a lot of old people drive them, so it's just to let them know to wake back up and crack up.
Yeah, okay, fair. I like how we're talking about fuel mileage, and this is going to be an endurance racing podcast as well. This works quite well. We're going to pretend that we're actually segueing in this, aren't we?
If you want a segue, I filled the GT86 up today, and that's the first time I've actually filled it up since the drive back from Le Mans, since I got off the ferry at Dover.
So how many tanks did you use then from home to home?
I filled up in Dover, filled up in Le Mans, filled up in Dover. So I get about 320 miles to a tank, because it's a thimble. It's a 40-litre tank.
You and performance cars with small tanks.
Yeah.
The VXR had like a 40-litre tank or something.
Yeah, the VXR had a 40-litre tank as well. I'm off 25 miles to the gallon, so I'm forever at fuel pump in that one.
Scott's going to be here in a minute asking what kilometres per litre that is.
Well, the VXR, actually, its fuel gauge, if you were using that much fuel, it would switch from miles per gallon to gallons per hour.
Remember they did that at Le Mans.
Does that if you're stopped, yes, if you're sitting still, it depends how much you're using. Right, endurance racing. Because we're just off the back of 3 24-hour races in a row. We had Le Mans, Nürburgring, and Spa. Sim, you attended Le Mans, so your opinion might differ. I was going to say it might differ from me and Matt. Matt and I might have a completely different opinion anyway. What was your feeling about Le Mans this year? Just in general.
Good race, not a classic, little bit flat. Felt like Ferrari were going to win it from pretty early on, but a good race nonetheless. You know, it had to run well. There was still intrigue right up to the end. It felt like Ferrari had it in the bag, but there was always that possibility that there was going to be a slight curveball that meant the Estre Porsche could take the win.
That's really interesting that you said that, so we'll come back to that in a minute. Matt, what was your opinion on Le Mans this year?
I found it quite strange that throughout the race, it kind of felt, at the time, it felt flat, but then when it got towards the end and you look back at the race, you were actually like, oh, actually quite a bit was happening. It just sort of didn't seem like it at the time.
Okay. Let's keep. We're going to do corporate speak. Let's put a pin in that. Come back to that in a minute. Right. Sim, you've voiced an opinion on the Spa 24 hours before. So rather than me paraphrase it, what's your general opinion of the Spa 24 hours? Not necessarily the last running, but just in general.
I do not enjoy the Spa 24 hours. It feels too prescriptive. It feels like everyone just has to do the exact same thing for the first 23 and a quarter hours, and then there's 45 minutes racing at the end.
Matt, I don't know if you're into the Spa 24 quite as much as Sim and I, but do you have an opinion on Spa?
So I don't have any kind of insight or what I'd call technical knowledge about the event. But my only thought, especially this year, was when I was 20, the idea of Le Mans, Nürburgring, Spa being week after week after week would have been ideal, and I probably had the time in life to actually make the most of that. Whereas now, 15 years later, I'm kind of like, by Spa, I was almost burnt out in a way, and it was a bit like, well, I've been through Le Mans, and I dedicated my weekend to Le Mans, and then I spent a lot of a weekend watching Nürburgring. It's like, oh, like, then I just don't know as much about Spa anyway. So I was less kind of into it. I wasn't really sure kind of which drivers I wanted to follow or anything like that. And as classic as Spa is, as good as Spa is, when it's following Le Mans and the full Nordschleife, it's a bit tame. It just didn't pull me in.
Actually, let's talk about that a bit first then, because I agree with you that 3 24-hour races in a row is probably a bit much, even for a hardcore motorsport fan. Similar to you in my mid to early 20s, or even late 20s, I would have had time for that. But now, I didn't have time to sit and watch 3 races in a row like that, whilst also mixing in F1 and any other series that we wanted to watch. But another reason I think Spa suffers is it was the third of the 3 And arguably, it's the worst of the three, which is probably a pretty harsh way of saying it. It's the least best of the three. It's maybe a better way of putting it.
It's a very high bar.
Part of that, it's a very high bar, isn't it? It's like, let's be completely fair there. It's not like we're watching Vauxhall Novas at Snetterton, which might be your thing, actually.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, hold back there, lad.
I think Spa suffers because it's not really multi-class. So yes, it's multi-class, but only by driver rating, and that's not the same. So it feels a little bit prescriptive because of that as well. It feels like there's less jeopardy, I suppose, when everybody's just driving a GT3 that's all the same speed. I think Spa would have worked better as a warm-up to the other two. If you put Spa first and then Le Mans and Nürburgring in whichever order you prefer, it might have been a bit better. But for what you were saying there, is like, so I agree with both of you there about Le Mans and Spa. Nürburgring's a separate example. We'll come back to that later. So why did Le Mans feel a little flat? Because I felt like it was getting a little bit prescriptive, like Spa. I think that's a really good word for it. It's not quite the same. It's not just GT3s driving around all in one class. But do you not feel like Le Mans is getting a little bit too prescriptive? It's, I can't think of a better word for that. It's people are all doing the same thing with the same cars. We've all got, tell you what, then I'll just go through my notes because I've got a theory for you.
Go on.
So is the racing too close at Le Mans?
If you mean what I think you mean, then yes.
So in theory, the last 2 years should be the most exciting Le Mans we've ever had, because that is the two closest finishes with most cars on the lead lap and all that good stuff. And it, don't get me wrong, was good. Really, really good. Really enjoyed it. But there was no danger of anything changing, in my opinion. Like Sim said, is like it was pretty clear Ferrari were going to win it. And why were Ferrari going to win it? It's like, well, you can argue about BOP until the end of time. BOP was maybe very slightly off. But before, we've seen bigger variances in cars be overcome compared to the current BOP. So the BOP being that slightly off, where over 24 hours, it only wins by a few seconds or whatever, that's actually really close. So maybe BOP is not really the actual problem here. Maybe it's everything else surrounding it. BOP's not only equalized the cars, but it's equalized everything. We've also equalized pit stops. All the pit stops are the same now. There's not as much strategy involved as there used to be. There's not as many teams doing no tires when other teams are doing two tires and other teams are doing four tires. Same with pit stop lengths. Stint lengths are all the same. You go, all right, okay, well, that's one problem. The next problem is each car has converged on the same kind of format. Back in the LMP1s, and I know somebody's going to write in and say they were too expensive, and I agree, but we're not saying the LMP1s are better, we're illustrating why hypercars have got a problem. Back in the LMP1s, you had three completely different engines with turbocharged, naturally aspirated, three different sizes of engines, different fuels, and then you had three different hybrid systems, and they did begin to converge a little bit, but it didn't get exactly the same. Now, everybody's landed on the same kind of same solution to the problem, and they're all producing lap times in the same way. So we're almost getting to like a spec series. And you go, okay, so what's the last bit of this? The last bit is the cars are too reliable. Because before, when we had the LMP1s, when we even had Porsche and Toyota, do you remember that year that everybody said Toyota were definitely, definitely, definitely 100% going to win, and there was three Toyotas? And they all just kept falling off. And then one of the Porsches was definitely going to win, and that one broke down. And then the other Porsche was definitely going to win, and that one broke down, and it ended up with a Jota P2 leading for a good chunk of the race before the Porsche clawed it back. There was jeopardy back then. There was the potential of something happening. Now, the cars are too reliable. But why are they too reliable? It's like, because we're not really pushing the boundary of technology anymore. We've all got what is essentially underpowered hybrid systems compared to what they were before. They're well within the engineering bounds. Same with the engines. Aerodynamically, the cars are not that special. They're basically doing LMP2 lap times from a few years ago. So the LMP2s have got to be slowed down in order to not catch the hypercars. So now you've got cars that are well within their engineering boundaries, not breaking down. They're all producing lap times in the same way because they've all converged, because that is the best way to do this. And BOP has equalized them. So now there's no variables for anybody to move. You get out there and you run your race. You do qualifying lap after qualifying lap because your car's not going to break down. It's relatively easy to drive. And the end result is, if Ferrari are 1/10 faster per lap, that's it. You're not overcoming that. The only thing you could do is hope to do is get lucky in traffic. And I feel like Spa is the extreme example of that, where the rules actually say is like, you may not run longer than this. You may not do this. You may not do that. And everybody ends up with essentially the same race despite different cars. Le Mans has accidentally created this situation by having the BOP, by having this oddly strict rule set that ends up with everybody doing the same thing and no chance of a car breaking down. And all these teams are super professional as well anyway, compared to what they were like 30 years ago or so. So I think this rule set might be hurting Le Mans overall, in my opinion, because this should be the most exciting race we've ever had. But to me, it was flat, and it was flat because the potential's gone, the jeopardy's gone, because everything's just producing the same. And thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
I think it's an interesting theory. Since I've got back from Le Mans, I've watched several Le Mans reviews / extended highlights. What have I watched? I've watched 95, 97, 99, 2000, 2001, 2003. And I think 98 was a particular one I was watching that was pretty good. Because I think 6 hours in, the Toyotas had something like a 2-lap lead from the Porsches. And you're thinking, that's a really bad Le Mans. But actually, it was brilliant because then the Toyotas broke down, spent 20 minutes in the pits, which gave the Porsche a 2-lap advantage. They fixed the gearbox on the Toyota. It came back out. It caught that 2 laps up. You know, you could feel the excitement building. Oh, he was 5 seconds a lap faster. He's 6 seconds. Oh, he's lost a second there as he's going through the traffic. Eventually, he caught and overhauled the Porsche. And then it broke down again. And it's like, okay, so the winning Porsche, I think it won by a lap or 2 laps or something like that. So if you look at the results on paper, you go, it won by 2 laps. Not that interesting. Ferrari won this year by 13 seconds. Interesting. In reality, so much happened to lead to that 2-lap victory. It was a far more interesting race than, as you say, two cars chasing each other around, slowly pulling away at a tenth of a second a lap.
We actually saw a version of this about 5 or 6 years ago as well, maybe a little bit more than that, when they BOP'd the GTE class for the first time. And it ended up being that, I can't remember what happened exactly, but it was something like a safety car split the GTE field and Ford ended up with a third of a lap lead and nobody could overcome a third of a lap in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And that is madness. That's not okay, really, in my opinion.
It is, like, initially, like, on the outside, you'd imagine the aim of BOP to bring all the cars to a similar lap time. But then when you think about it, if all the cars are doing a similar lap time, then they're not going to be racing as such because, like you say, they're going to be so close and not going to be able to overcome even the smallest of gaps. So then it's like, how should BOP work then? Because you can't just BOP cars to random times to try and create some variance. It has to try and bring the cars together, but then that kind of breaks the whole racing aspect. It's actually quite complicated.
I've got another part of the theory on that in that I think BOP only works properly in privateer classes, which technically the Spa 24 Hours is. And I know there's some kind of semi-works teams in there with Manti, but not really, not like Le Mans hypercars. There's nothing else like that. I think BOP only works in that regard because there's enough variance between the team's abilities and the driver's abilities that it's not the be-all and end-all. You can overcome it. Spa felt like it had more jeopardy and more potential for things going wrong than Le Mans did, despite in theory it having less variables because everybody's got the same class of cars. So you're not even tripping over traffic or anything like that compared with Le Mans. So I feel like when you BOP factory stuff, that's when you get the problem because the standard is so high. And I know we sit and laugh at teams like Peugeot and Alpine and even Lamborghini. But in reality, the standard there is so much higher than what it is at GT3. And everybody's within a second round Le Mans, which is absolute madness when you actually think about it. So I don't think you can or should BOP factory for performance variability reasons. But there's another point which we'll talk about later on, which I think you guys know exactly what I'm going to say about manufacturers not liking BOP. Total Wolf said it recently as well. But I genuinely think it makes the racing worse because the standard is too high and everybody just runs at 100% at all times with no errors. And I think this is what we're seeing as the result.
I think you hit it earlier as well, saying that the cars aren't stressed. You think about LMP, the P was prototype and the cars were prototype. These hypercars, you have to submit your designs and then it's homologated for, 5 years, I think it is, and you're allowed to make one upgrade in that time. You're not chucking bits at the car to try and find that extra half a second a lap that's then, it might break down. You might get a bit more jeopardy. You might get that second a lap, but is it only going to last for 12 hours instead of 24? Was it Aston Martin, the AMI-01? I know it was a terrible car, but part of the reason that broke was because they changed a part a couple of weeks before Le Mans and didn't, correctly calculate the frequencies. You're not going to get that anymore because Toyota, Peugeot aren't going to chuck a part at a car that they haven't already put 50,000 miles on because then they can't change it for another 5 years. And that gets away from what Le Mans is for me. Le Mans is about the prototypes and whether it's, been called Group C, LMP, 900, 675, P1, P2. It's got away from that, and I think it needs to bring that part back at least. You can BOP all you want, but maybe let's take away the homologation windows as well.
So I'm going to suggest something that I'm not being original with because you suggested it, and Total Wolf has just suggested it. It should just be a cost cap. If we're just trying to keep costs down, let's be honest, Formula One has managed to do quite a good job of policing the budgets despite Red Bull's sandwich budget going a little bit out of hand. If they can do it, so can the ACO. It's the same theory. That's what it should be moved to. And then you do a Group C style thing of this is how much fuel you've got. Here's some basic regulations so it doesn't get completely out of hand. Here's a cost cap. Off you go. That would produce more variety in racing. Because let's be honest, if you took away the BOP, the Ferrari would be significantly faster than the Peugeot, for example. So you would get that variety. And then it would be on teams to actually perform. Because we also have this rule that nobody's allowed to complain about the BOP. But yeah, everybody's currently complaining about the BOP. They're just not using the letters B, O, or P whilst complaining about it. So we could do away with all of this with a cost cap and some basic technical regulations, I think.
There is some form of cost cap, isn't there, at the minute? Some sort of regulation there.
It's not enforced. It's more of a suggested cost cap is the way I understand it.
Because when I try and put myself, it's never going to happen, but myself as on the board of a car manufacturer, I don't know, Nissan, for example. If someone comes to me and says, I want to enter a car into Le Mans. And I'm like, right, here's the money. Let's do it. Let's go and win. Let's throw money at it. And we'll build this amazing car. We can go and win. So we spend all this money to build this amazing car. And then it gets a big restrictor put on the engine and it gets extra weight added. And then I'm like, surely the manufacturers are thinking, what was the point? We may as well spend as little as possible and get BOP'd into it rather than try and build the best car we can and get BOP down. So where is a cost cap? You can literally go to the board and say, this is the budget, let's do it. And then there is the drive to kind of innovate and kind of build the best car possible.
I mean, that was Big Jim's argument, wasn't it, for Glickenhaus, that the reason he didn't update the car was his argument was, it's a BOP formula. I shouldn't have to be spending money to upgrade my car. You should just be moving the parameters so my car's more competitive.
And although I don't like the argument, it's not wrong, is it? The whole point is you should be able to achieve the same speed with a car that fits into the window. And I liked Matt's thing about, a board's not going to spend money in order for the car to be slowed down. But I think when it comes to the car manufacturers, they always underestimate how difficult it is to actually run a race team. So they think, oh, that's fine. If all the cars are equal, we'll just execute better than everybody else. And then Iron Lynx happens and you see what goes on there. So I feel like they're just overconfident. And to me, that's just going to create a churn of manufacturers. So are we going to lose Peugeot at some point? Yeah, probably. Let's be honest, they're not executing that well. The car's not that great, but even though it's been updated, it's still not that great. We're going to lose them. Like that's going to happen. We've already lost Lamborghini. I know we've technically not fully lost them, but realistically, we have. We're going to introduce Ford. We're going to introduce Genesis and Hyundai brand. How long before those churn through when they end up spending the cost cap and being like, well, we're spending the same as Ferrari, but we're ninth. So what's the point? You know, it doesn't actually matter that you're on the lead lap of Le Mans if you're ninth. Before, a lead lap finish was an incredible thing. Now it's almost a given, except for instead of second, you're ninth. So I don't see this as a long-term thing, because I think they've extended the rule set to something like, was it 2032? 2035, something like that?
Yeah, 32, I think it is, isn't it?
We're going to churn through a lot of manufacturers by then, and I just don't see it as sustainable. I think we're just going to end up annoying manufacturers who are interested in Le Mans, who'll just end up going out of Le Mans unhappy and being away for 10, 20 years, because that's what car manufacturers tend to do, is disappear for long periods of time. And I think we're just going to churn through and annoy them at this rate.
I wonder how BMW feel about their WEC program, specifically in the hypercar, because they're anonymous. They are so anonymous. They're never going to challenge Ferrari. They're not hilariously at the back with Peugeot. They're just there. And I wonder how much money they must be spending to have that car there, which is probably on an advertising budget more than anything. But what is it achieving? I don't understand what it would be.
It's difficult to market. We finish sixth every week.
Yeah.
You know, at least you could say is like Porsche are winning races. Ferrari are winning a lot more, obviously. But the Porsche can at least market, you know, we're taking the fight to Ferrari at Le Mans. That's a thing. That's a thing you can see. BMW saying, we fought Alpine and beat them to seventh. It's not a thing you can market, is it? And it's also not an engineering thing you can get out of it, because there's no engineering to come out of these cars, because they're so well within their engineering boundaries that there's no value engineering-wise there. The hybrid systems are fine.
The BMW is what, a P2 chassis with a DTM engine and a off-the-shelf hybrid?
Yeah. It's, in theory, all of these rules sound great. Like, if you had proposed these rules during the LMP1s, I think we would have all went, oh, that sounds like a great idea. But somehow they've done the opposite of synergy, and they've added up to less of the sum of their parts, and it's just a little bit flat. And I think it needs fixed before 2032, but I don't have a huge amount of faith in the ACO actually doing that.
So I like the idea of a cost cap. I'm big on cost cap. Here's your budget. Spend what you want. You get what you get at the end of it. I was thinking about this during the Spa 24 whilst I was otherwise engaged and had lots of time to think. And the Valkyrie popped into my head. How would you fit the Valkyrie's development into a budget cap?
Oh, interesting, because the Valkyrie road car would be outside of the budget cap, so you would just spend all your money on a road car.
So I'm not saying it's the Ford GT method of the car, but I did think, yeah, how would you do that? What would stop, you know, Porsche coming up with a 964 RP2 and then, oh, here, Roger Penske, here's your custom car. By the way, we're going to go race this at Le Mans. Isn't that going to be good?
It's basically what Red Bull were accused of with the Valkyrie, wasn't it? Of sending Adrian
using that to get around the F1 wind tunnel regulations, yeah.
I mean, you're completely right. I don't have an answer for that.
Go for it, to be honest.
Yeah. I did have one suggestion. The only thought I could think was, in the rules, there's a stipulation that you must sell your car or anybody must be able to buy that car from you for X amount of pounds. So you say you could spend 130 million a year. If you've developed it outside the budget, great. But Aston Martin, BMW could rock up tomorrow and buy a Valkyrie off you for 13 million pounds. And then they can reverse engineer it. Or Dave Ellis Motor Racing, TRL can rock up, buy a Valkyrie for 13 million pounds off them, go and run that in the WEC. It's how Porsche became successful in the Group C era. They were selling, you know, 962s, 956s to anybody who rocked up. And they didn't care if it was a factory team winning or not, as long as a Porsche was winning. And the way they saw it, the more they sold, the more likely it was Porsche were going to win Le Mans. So that's the only way around it I could think.
Yeah, I guess the one issue with it now is it's harder to sell customer cars with the hybrid systems, isn't it? Because there's just not the engineering knowledge throughout the privateer teams to run them. I was about to say Manti probably don't have somebody, but Manti's probably the closest actually to having somebody that could run something like that. But you couldn't sell one of those to
Motorsport
or something.
If you're BMW or Alpine or Ferrari going to buy, you know, whatever's winning, you're not necessarily buying it to run it, are you? You're buying it to take it apart. I mean, Dave, you're almost certainly familiar with the genesis of the Mercedes, what were they, CLK LMs?
Based off the McLaren F1
They bought a McLaren F1 GTR and, you know, fitted their running gear into it and then the body kit around that and used it as a base for their own Le Mans car. So there's precedent for that sort of thing.
I like that idea. A cost cap with basic regulations, Group C type stuff of this is the resources you're allowed to run with. Also, you must be able to sell the cars, let's say after a couple of years when you've worked out the kinks as a customer project. That would create an interesting thing as well because we're moving into the idea of hypercars being in a regional series for the first time, the Asian Le Mans series getting hypercars. So you could potentially extend the grid somewhat by having enforced cheaper to run hypercars. Yeah, I like that idea. The more I think about it, the more I like it.
Good.
The other thing, but we probably shouldn't spend too much time on it, is LMP2 is really boring now.
Yes, it's very sad.
I'm just finished watching Elms at Imola as well, which was a great race, by the way.
It was.
But every time I watch Elms, the Elms commentary team is determined to tell me how exciting it is because all the cars are the same. But a few years ago, they were determined to tell me how exciting it is because all the cars were different. And I feel like I'm being preached at a little bit when I watch Elms because they're preached at, but maybe making excuses for it. LMP2, as a racing fan, I currently see as a failure in its current format. I know it's a... It's a financial success because we have a lot more teams in it than we used to. It's certainly a financial success for Hugh de Schoenaeck, isn't it? He's absolutely loving the amount of orcas he's selling. But in terms of a racing fan, I would say LMP2 is a bit of a failure. We've gone from, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 potential manufacturers and engines and all very different combinations to everyone now has exactly the same. We've got the same chassis, same engine, same tire. And that's just a bit deflating, to be honest. So when your top class at Le Mans isn't producing the variety, your second class is a spec series. I know somebody's going to write in and say, oh, it's not a spec series because you're allowed to enter something. It's a spec series shop. It's the same as the AF Corsa Ferrari. It's a factory car. It's just a little bit disappointing. And I was a bit sad that the LMP2 regs aren't sorting that with the next generation either. They're just sticking with the same thing and everybody gets to build another car. But Orica have had now a decade or so of dominating it. Of course their car's going to be better than everybody else's in round two. So LMP2 is not bringing the interest in the way that it used to either, which is a bit of a shame.
So I like LMP2, and the argument outside of spectators is that it develops teams for the top class. And if you look at the teams that are running hypercars, you can say they've done a good job. Jota, United Autosports are bringing the McLaren. Obviously, Prema, they ran in P2 before they jumped up to, with it was Lamborghini they ran, wasn't it, originally, I think. They ran something anyway.
Yeah. They're running an Indy car now.
Yeah. But trackside at Le Mans, it was so hard to follow the P2 because commentary never talk about it. You know, that you get the standings on the hourly update, but the focus was always on the hypercar class, and then they jump to the GT class and, oh, by the way, P2 and the Pro-Am P2. On top of that, a great addition this year was position boards on the sides of the cars at Le Mans. So I know in the past I've had the leader lights, the first, second, third, one light your first, two lights your second, three lights your third, sod everybody else after that, you don't really matter. This year they had digital LED boards which showed the actual position of the car. They only had them in Hypercar and GT3. So it was really, really difficult to follow them trackside. So it became a non-event for me, the P2 class, to be honest.
I didn't realise they didn't have the new leaderboards, which also demonstrates how little TV showed them as well.
Yeah.
But I do have the same feeling of, even on TV, they rarely spoke about the LMP2s. And the thing I love about LMP2 is the teams. There's such a nice variety of teams in there and driver layouts and all the rest of it. It's just the cars that are in it. And I can't help but think how much better it would be if, for example, Inter-Europol were running a Ligier, or somebody was running a Dallara, or somebody was insane enough to run a Riley or something like that. I just feel like it's a missed opportunity, really. Somehow the cars are more expensive than they used to be, despite Hagemann and Monopoly, which is, yay, capitalism. And we're not going to fix that, which is a bit of a shame, really. I feel like if we're overhauling the hypercar class, we should also be overhauling the LMP2s as well to add the variety back. Otherwise, we're going to end up with spec series for LMP2 and a kind of weird de facto spec series for hypercar.
And I'm fine with P2 being a spec series, but then there's the argument that maybe it shouldn't be at Le Mans anymore.
I'd be sad to not have that middle class, to be honest. So do you remember many years ago now that we sped up LMP2 because they weren't fast enough to overtake the GT3s in a straight line?
Yeah.
So the AMs were essentially dive bombing GT3s because it was the only way they could pass traffic. And it's creating accidents that weren't really anybody's fault, just due to situations. I'd like to go back to that. I'd like the hypercars sped up to partially resolve some of their problems. I'd like the LMP2s sped up to be a little bit harder to drive and give them more of a delta to the GT3s again. And I'd like the other manufacturers to be in LMP2. So here's the daft thing, is that the factory hypercars are BOP'd and the privateer LMP2s are not. I know they kind of are, but they're not. That's not how it should be. We're BOPing the top class, and then the class that is a good argument for trying to BOP them. We're not BOPing them, and everybody's bought the same car anyway. This is backwards. It's very easy.
Yes.
It does feel, like you mentioned there, Sim, with the leaderboard panels. You talk about the coverage. And you also mentioned briefly there, Dave, you got the LMP2 and then LMP2 Pro-Am, which is like a subclass, but not. They get a separate trophy, don't they? But then kind of lumped in, especially in the coverage, they're lumped into the same class. And it's all a mishmash of either ignored or half-assed kind of things. And I think that's kind of what spoils it, when even subconsciously you just get that sense that nobody really cares in a way about it. And like I say, it's all conversion to one chassis, one engine. And I think, a big part of it now is a breeding ground of drivers and teams for progression. But it used to be such a great class of variety, racing kind of, basically it was almost the perfect class for what it was. And like I say, it pushed the LMP1s further, really wasn't an issue with the GT cars at the time. So it's kind of, when you see it's fallen from there and the lap times got slower, obviously not their fault as such, and the coverage has just dwindled down on it. And the, again, innovation and lack of, you know, you think back to, you know, things like the Porsche RS Spyder that came in was just insane. And there's just none of that now. So, yeah, it's core. It's still a great class. It's the perfect kind of level, especially for gentlemen drivers to come in and experience, especially Le Mans, but endurance racing as a whole. But it's just been so sterilized and neutered and forgotten about that it's lost that charm that it had, I think.
I'd agree with that. And it's kind of weird for them to be such a big deal in Asian Le Mans series, which is doing really well nowadays, big grids, and such a big deal in Elms, obviously. And then they turn up at WEC and they don't even get a mention. And it's kind of weird. And I feel like that's a manufacturer thing. The ACO loves a manufacturer. They don't actually care about private teams that much. They care about manufacturers. That's why we're concentrating on hypercar, and that's why GT's got significantly more coverage than the LMP2s. Because if you throw some coverage at Mercedes, who knows? Maybe Toto Wolff will change his mind. I mean, he's not going to, but who knows? He might do. That's manufacturer badges on the screen, and that's the kind of thing that they want at Le Mans. They will concentrate on getting manufacturers into the fault, I suppose, of the other classes and even the top class. I think the series is overall worse off since we're concentrating on manufacturers. That's the other thing with hypercars, isn't it? You're not even allowed to build one if you're not rich. You can't just rock up with a car, because even if you do call us, you'll get told to go away because you're not a real manufacturer. And that's a little bit sad, because I quite liked when ridiculous cars would turn up last three laps and explode on lap four down the Mulsanne or whatever. That was part of the fun. Or the Lamborghini having to get a gearbox out of a road car in the car park and stuff. And I feel like that's gone a little bit, which is sad.
I watched recently, there's on YouTube, there's a documentary, a three-part documentary on creation and kind of their effort. And, you know, they were testing at Paul Ricard, but they could only do a certain amount of hours. And then they thought Michelin messed the tires up and they'd lost all this money on testing because they couldn't run how they wanted. And then they found out it was a small part of suspension. And like, it's obviously still a very rich man at the top of it, but it's this team without the manufacturer backing. They're doing all these things to try and work out, and then they get to Le Mans, and I think it was Judd providing them with a new engine, but they couldn't fit it straight away because they didn't know if it'd have the amount of mileage to last the race if they fit it too early in the week. So they had to fit it later in the week to make sure. And like, yeah, you just can't imagine that now at all. And that was a magical Le Mans, that people could just rock up at this mega track in this mega race and just have a go. And I can understand why, you know, the push has been on manufacturers and pushing out privateers. It's where the money is. It's where the stability is, in a way. But that's not what it, you know, it's not F1. It's not, in essence, it wasn't a professional race. It was almost not an amateur race as such, but yeah, it had that mix. Whereas now, like I say, that's been removed as well. So again, when you talk about the race feeling flat, there isn't that kind of, you know, from a punter point of view, you haven't got anyone to kind of almost relate to in a weird way, because everybody's a manufacturer. You haven't got Mr. Creation, I can't remember his name now, but you wouldn't be supporting him and that bloke putting his money in. You know, just looking at corporations and budgets rather than, yeah, passion projects.
So if Le Mans has lost the spirit of Le Mans, you know what's gained it, I think, despite everything we've said, is the Nürburgring. Because that race is still unbelievably wild every single time, despite in theory being the same as the Spa 24, where you've got GT3 cars that are all BOP'd, or the same as Le Mans, where you've got multi-class, but it's all really tight and everything's BOP'd to the nth degree. And yet, it never is. It's completely wild every time. And that's because the amount of traffic and the size of the lap give you variety, which give you potential, which give you jeopardy. Like, Jeopardy is just a Nürburgring all over, isn't it? It's like every corner is Jeopardy. The race changed this year because Manti were given a penalty for making an attempted pass on a back marker that they probably made 20 times a lap for 20 hours. And yet this one time it went wrong and they lost the race because of that penalty. I would argue that the Nürburgring is currently the greatest spirit of Le Mans because you can just rock up with any old thing. There's a whole bunch of amateurs in there who just want to go driving. The Dacia is an extreme example, but how many people are in those BMWs that are basically built to go racing at Le Mans and things like that? And there's a Subaru Impreza in there. There's a Volkswagen Golf. And it's like, these are people who just want to go racing, and they get to go racing, and they get to be on the same track as the pros for 24 hours. The cars are all breaking down because they're not real race cars. So they're not really engineered to do this kind of thing. So, you know, of course your differential on your BMW 3 Series is blown up. It's like you bought it in a car dealership a few weeks ago. Of course it's all falling apart. Like, love that. That, to me, is the ultimate spirit of Le Mans, whereas Le Mans is going the way of the Spa 24 hours. So I would argue the Nürburgring might be overtaking Le Mans as currently the greatest 24-hour race in the world.
I mean,
that's a sentence and a half, I know.
Even in SP9 class, which is GT3, you've got the benefit of different strategies. From memory, you had some of the leaders start pitting at the end of lap 4, even though I think I'm right in saying they could do 7 laps, maybe 8 to a tank. And that's all because of the way they do their pit stop times. And your pit stop time depends how the length of your pit stop depends on how much time there is to the end of the race in the last couple of hours of it and all that. So you had some teams trying to pit earlier so that they'd end up with a shorter pit stop at the end of the race. And all that was like, oh, that's just, like I say, it's an extra layer. Not everybody's doing the same thing. It's a variable which is causing the differences. And of course, there's always one way that's faster than another on paper, but you know, to butcher a famous football phrase, the game isn't played on paper. It's played out there on the tarmac. So, you know, take the punt, see what happens.
As well as that, is that you get a lot more freedom, despite it being in theory a BOP class at the top. There's been a couple of years where teams have changed tire manufacturer or supplier mid-event. Before the race starts, they move from qualifying, I can't remember what it was, let's say Falcons to Michelins or something like that, because the weather forecast changed and they knew that they would provide better wet weather tires. Imagine doing that one. Imagine somebody rocking up and going like a set of Yokohamas for P1. Like that, you're not actually allowed to do that, never mind it just being an option. And that, to me, is kind of the magic of the Nürburgring, or as I used to say, the magic of Le Mans. You have this freedom to basically do these things. And the other thing is like, let's be honest, motor racing is complicated. It is a complicated sport to watch, probably much more so than most sports. Le Mans is pretty complicated. Nürburgring kind of crosses a threshold where it's so complicated, it doesn't actually matter anymore. Because even the hardcore fans just go, don't understand this, just shut up and enjoy it. Oh, he's got to do a pit stop that's slightly longer. Just, oh, fuck, I'll just accept it. Fine. It is what it is. Whereas Le Mans, you're determined to understand everything because it feels within reach. And I find the Nürburgring more enjoyable that way. It's just like, I don't need to think about this because it's so daft. Just watch it. And I absolutely loved it.
Do you know what I think part of that is? Is that the ADAC who organise it, they're open. Everything is explained as to why they're doing it. So, yes, I know they have different lengths of pit stops depending on where you're pitting. I don't fully understand it, but I know I could go onto their website and work it out if I wanted to. Whereas the ACO is very, it's going to be like this because we say it's going to be like that. And then it leaves that, everyone's always had that suspicion that the BOP for Ferrari was favourable in 23 because, you know, the optics of a Ferrari win on their 50th anniversary of their last win on the 100th anniversary of the race was very good. So the BOP changes a couple of weeks before was a little bit, you know, what you're doing here. Whereas for the Ring 24, they literally just lay it out on paper. The car was too fast on the straight, so we took some power away. You know, they just tell you what they're doing. So like I say, it's so much more complicated, but you're right, it really doesn't matter because I kind of trust that what I'm seeing out there is everybody doing the absolute best job they can. And that's the reason they're winning or they're upside down in a barrier or they're on fire in the forest.
I think one of the best examples of the BOP issues at ACO was when they first introduced it and they were like, there's not going to be any manual stuff. It's all an algorithm. You put the data in, you get a result, that's it. And they would do that. They put the data in, get a result. And then after a practice session, they completely redo it and you'd end up with a different BOP. And you're like, well, but the data was the same. Yeah. There's not been a race run since then. So did you change the data you were putting in or did you change the algorithm? Because you cannot get a different result out if you put the same data into the same algorithm unless you had some weird ChatGPT thing where you just kept pressing refresh to see what you get. And I think that's one of the reasons it wasn't trustworthy, is they said, this is how it will be. And then they immediately changed it. And they did it before Le Mans as well, didn't they? They changed it after a test day or something like that, after saying they will definitely, definitely not change it. And then they went, we didn't really pinky swear on that one. Let's change it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the only other thing to talk about, and unfortunately it's a bit of a negative, is I've sat on this podcast and talked about how the Nürburgring is the gold standard for this, how drivers are held in safety. That is the absolute gold standard. You will get told, go home if you do something stupid. Turns out, if you're a pro driver, you won't get told to go home. In fact, you'll get told to go home after the race is finished, at the same time everybody else gets told to go home. Was it Bortolotti passed? Was it 8 red flags? Was it Bortolotti? I think it was.
Yeah, Bortolotti.
That's what I was getting confused at. Bortolotti passed 8 red flags. 8 red flags and overtook another car. And they weren't even like hidden red flags. They were super obvious. It was very obvious what was going on. And then he has the audacity to jump on the radio and ask his engineer what's going on. I said, well, the flag marshals are telling you what's going on out there. It was pretty obvious. And what did he get? He got a suspended ban, suspended until after the race was done. So he gets his license removed after the race is finished, thus being no penalty at all, because he's now got a year of NLS to reapply for his license, essentially. So that it's basically no penalty. There's probably a monetary fine in there, which didn't mean anything either.
He was put to the back of the grid as well. It's just the class one grid, not the entire grid. Just the what is it, class? I can't remember what they're called. Group one, sorry. Group one, because they have three starting groups, don't they?
Yeah. So absolutely nothing then. Meanwhile, a couple of popular YouTubers committed smaller crimes than that and were rightly given quite large penalties for it. But then Bortolotti created a much worse crime and basically got no penalty. So now we've got the message of pros are okay, but AMs are not. And that's back to the argument that we've had on Vocast a few times of why are Formula One drivers held to a lower standard than Formula Four drivers? Turns out Nürburgring might have a little bit of that as well. Within the same race, they will hold pro drivers to a lower standard. That was the most disappointing thing I've seen from the Nürburgring, because they should be better than that.
Yeah, their reasoning for the penalty sort of felt like they were scrambling for a reason not to ban him from the race. They said he was passing the red flags at an area of the track where he'd passed the incident, so there was no real danger.
But he doesn't know that.
Yeah, exactly. And it sort of felt like to me they were just, well, they're trying to justify their decision to not send him home. And I think the real reason they didn't want to send him home is because I think by rule you have to have 4 drivers per car in the Ring 24. And at that point, it would have only left them with 3 drivers. And so that would have been another SP9 car out, because was it the Lawrence Vanthoor car had to pull out because of an accident?
Yeah.
So part of me does think, again, you've rightly applauded them for not taking the consequences of an incident or, you know, the optics of what their decision are going to be into account previously. But it seems like for some reason they did both of those on this one, and rightly so, a lot of people were up in arms about it and just said, you know, this is completely the wrong decision.
And I tell you what, it's like, I think you're exactly right there. It's like they didn't want to lose the driver because then you lose the car. But then, as you said, the Lawrence Vanthoor car was out, so there's 4 drivers with ring permits that you could transplant into that car, and I'm pretty sure one of them would have been able to do it contractually. Probably not Vanthoor, being a pro Porsche driver, shoving him in a Lamborghini is going to cause it, but there'd be somebody kicking around with a ring license. Mm. And you go, oh, well, they're not as fast. Well, that's what you get for your pro driver being a dick then.
It's something like 700 drivers in that race, I think. You're telling me not one of them could have stepped in. So,
was there not a couple of drivers double card as well? Because the rules still usually allow that at the Nürburgring. Yeah, I'm sure you can find a pro driver in there that will happily drive two cars at the same time. Like, 100% you could. I heard what you're saying about, like, they said, oh, he's already passed the accident. It's like, well, first of all, he doesn't know that. Like, he doesn't even know they're at red, never mind where the accident is. But also, the Nürburgring is unique in that you can have service vehicles on the circuit at any time. So if he's not seeing the red flags, that means he's also not going to be seeing those rolling yellow flags that you get for articulated lorries that are doing barrier repairs at the Nürburgring. That's like ignoring a flag at one circuit's thing, but at the Nürburgring, it's just especially bad given how that race runs. And that race only works if people obey the flag rules religiously. When you stop doing that, that race stops working. And frankly, we can't host that race because people will die if everybody drove like that all weekend. So unfortunately, the one disappointing thing to what was a great event, and it wasn't even that close an event other than the first two, but that was all you needed because it was a brilliant race with a lot of jeopardy and potential and variety. And to me, Nürburgring might be my favourite motor race at the moment, maybe outside of F1 for obvious reasons.
I mean, not to go too far into F1 on, you know, a sports car podcast, but when you talk about their jeopardy potential, that's exactly what F1's providing at the minute. That's why F1 is working so well.
Yeah, it's so here's the funny thing. It's like, I completely agree with you. But people say it's like F1 would be better if you gave them all the same car because they'd be closer. It's like, well, I don't actually think they would be closer for a start. I think you'd end up exactly the same. But F1 is producing some of the best racing in the world at the moment with 10 different cars. So, you know, without BOP, without weird regulations that are defining how far you can go. I know the tyres are artificially limited, but you've still got to get the best out of them. There's no rule that says you may not run mediums longer than this, things like that. F1's actually got it quite right at the moment, I think.
It's the cost cap.
It's hard to disagree, isn't it?
And it is funny, for years, I've always said about sports cars has an inferiority complex to F1. And I think at the minute it's actually justified because, the difference at the minute is kind of the biggest it's been in F1's favour for a long time.
I actually think Spa is fixable as well in that I think the way that the ACO is pandering to manufacturers, Spa is pandering to gentlemen drivers in GT3s and they are just filling the grid to an extreme extent. You don't need 70 GT3s. It doesn't add anything beyond 40. If you want to make that race more interesting, take out half the GT3s and replace them with GT4s with essentially pro drivers. Mm. And then you've got a multi-class race. And then all the GT3s that didn't make it in and the GT4s from the GT4 European series, you mash them into a couple of support races. And then you've got multi-class support races and a multi-class pro race at the end. That would be interesting. That would fix Spa, in my opinion.
This episode was brought to you by the Racing Line app, your personal motorsport calendar. Don't miss a single race. With over 150 series and 600 events, the Racing Line provides start times in your time zone, live streaming, and customizable notifications to alert you to the events that are important to you. Motor racing is our thing. Don't miss out on any of it. Get the Racing Line app from the App Store today.